You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we will talk with the legendary director and composer, Greg, John Carpenter, about films like Halloween and his new album. But first, we have new albums from Goat Girl and Madlib to review.
The crack, a pit, a long time ago. The people make their way to space. The people make their way away. The people make their way to space.
That is a little bit of a song called The Crack from the second album by South London's Goat Girl, On All Fours. Greg, I first discovered this four-piece band of brilliant women as a buried treasure, and I highlighted them a song from this upcoming album a couple of months ago. Then I dug deeper into their first album. They are recording for one of the most respected independent labels in history, still one of my favorites, Rough Trade, Jeff Travis. He always has his ear to the ground for up-and-coming groups that are doing things very differently. This second album is a departure from the first. This band is covering a lot of ground in a short career that started in 2016. As I said, four women came together with strong political beliefs and adventurous musical spirit. The new record is produced by Dan Carey of Kate Tempest and Bat for Lashes fame. Let's get into playing a track and we'll come back and give our reviews. This is a song called PTST, as in, you know, the favorite British drink, by Goat Girl on Sound Opinions.
PTST from a hot cup of tea. Chug, chug, chug along on the ferry. Dog man wouldn't even look back at me.
That is PTST from Goat Girl's new album On All Fours, Jim mentioned, second album, and a change from the first one. The first album was full of these punchy guitar-driven tracks. I love that record. This one is not a 180-degree move away from that, but it is different sounding. More of a club vibe, more atmospheric. The song's more stretched out, reflecting how the band wrote. The songwriting approach changed. It was more communal, more about them in a room. Developing these tracks and letting them sort of percolate and marinate a little bit in the atmosphere in that room. And, you know, at first you're kind of like, wow, it's a big change. But, you know, the more I listened to it, the more I grew to love it. You know, to say it's a mood album would dismiss it, I think. But it does has that effect of sort of being a trancey, cool club track like you might hear at a club. You know what really reminds me of, Jim, is that band from L.A., Warpaint. Lot of that vibe in this record, and that's a good thing for me. When I say that to say it's a mood album would be unfairly dismissing it, it's because there's a lot of substance to these songs. I mean, these songwriters are addressing the idea of heavy topics like climate change, you know,
and
making it feel kind of light and clubby, but at the same time, really skewering some problems with the way we address these kind of matters in our lives. You know, in a song like Body Baba, you know, which is very much of a lightweight sounding thing. It's not that at all. It feels like we're in infection. The singer is basically saying the idea of us approaching climate change is to dismiss it, to shove it under the carpet and pretend like it's not happening. Well, it is happening.
Feels like we're an infection.
The song The Crack hits on climate change, right, as well, tearing up and burning down, leave all sadness then, underground.
I'm glad you played that song PTST, Jim, because I think it really nails what this band is all about in terms of the way it addresses major problems in our society in kind of a everyday sense. The song documents what happened to the band's drummer, Rosie Bones, who identifies as non-binary, on a ferry in England. And, you know, a man walked by her and spilled hot tea on her, injuring her. It was essentially an assault. And then the man turns away and walks away without an apology.
Doesn't even say anything.
Yeah. And you know, in that little moment, you get a lot of information about, you know, the way the social mores are breaking down in our society because of gender identification. So they're addressing these big topics in a very everyday kind of way that fits in beautifully with the way this music is being constructed.
You know, a unfair rock critic shorthand, Greg, would be that the first album was strongly inspired by Sonic Youth. Boom! Mm-hmm. Noisy guitars, right? Yeah. And I think, and I, you know, I don't read others' reviews until after I've listened about 10 times and formulated my own thoughts. I'm shocked, I am, that Warpaint comes up, but nobody is saying Stereolab.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of Stereolab influence in terms of an amazing drummer, the straightforward motorique beats and the way it interacts with the bass, and the la-la-la-la, ba-ba-ba-ba kind of vocals bouncing around, and the incredible nonchalance in the delivery of vocalist guitarist Clottie Cream and her fellow guitarist vocalist Ellie. They all have, you know, Ramon Z names, all right? I love it. They're singing so calmly, and yet they are skewering somebody like that jerk on the ferry. I love this album. I really do. It's going to be a great year if we have 10 that are better than Goat Girls on All Fours.
That is the call from the new Mad Lib record, Sound Ancestors. Mad Lib, a.k.a. Otis Jackson Jr., a DJ, producer, multi-instrumentalist, and also a rapper who's been making records for decades now. He is best known, perhaps, for his collaborations. We recently paid tribute to MF Doom, the late rapper who was working with Mad Lib on his best-known record, Mad Villain. J Dilla was another longtime collaborator with Mad Lib, the late J Dilla. Freddie Gibbs, recently a project with Mad Lib. Talib Kweli, the list goes on. He's remixed the Blue Notes Records archives. Now he's got a new album called Sound Ancestors. That's a collaboration with Fortet, that British producer, Kieran Hebden. Hebden was best known for his work in Fortet, which sort of combined that IDM and a little bit of post-rock. And I think what you know, his friend Fortet said to Mad Lib was like, you've got to make a record that really encapsulates who you are. Let's sum you up. Let's bring you to a new generation of listeners who may be confused by this huge body of work you have.
Yeah.
Make that big, bold record that you've got in you that sort of brings together all your different influences. And that was what they were attempting to do with Sound Ancestors. We're going to talk about it in a second, but let's play a track from Sound Ancestors first. It's called Road of the Lonely Ones on Sound Opinions.
Can you tell me now?
That is Road of the Lonely Ones from the new album by Madlib, Sound Ancestors. Some people are saying the first proper Madlib solo album, although he's been recording for decades. If the goal, as you said in the introduction, Greg, was for Fortet asking his friend, this guy who so inspires him and so many others in the hip-hop world, to put out a record that sums up who you are, well, that's a losing project from the get-go, because who is Otis Jackson? Otis Jackson is a million different right. sounds and styles and personalities and moods. If he's working with MF Doom, if he's working with Freddie Gibbs, you know, there's a track on here, Two for Two, for Dilla. And he's paying tribute to a fellow sampling genius hip-hop producer extraordinaire Jay Dilla, who passed several years ago. And he really is Dilla in that track. He's channeling Dilla as he would do Dilla. You know, in the song we just played, Road of the Lonely Ones, that is a great example of a super knowledgeable producer digging deep for the Philly soul sound to build something new. A couple of tracks sampled there from The Ethics to great effect, right? The problem is we have 16 tracks, and there is so much variety, at times you will think your playlist skipped ahead. This is still Madlib? As a class in the genius and the invention that can still be brought to diverse sampling, Sound Ancestors is a fantastic record. As a consistent listen, I would pare it down by at least a half. I mean, there are tracks that just don't do it for me, like Hang Out, Phone Off. And we don't really get enough of Madlib rapping that might have given us a different context for some of these songs. Or am I wrong?
Well, I think you're wrong, because I think it's all about the sampling, the art of sampling. I think Madlib is one of the people who sort of built that art form, or helped build it anyway.
I don't disagree.
The idea of taking sampling and building an entire record out of that. There are no guest vocalists. There are no cameos on this. This is the crate digger Madlib coming up with these sounds and putting them together, and then with Fortet sort of adding a few things here and there, but basically kind of sequencing and orchestrating it. And I think Fortet encouraged him to go wide and long on this record. So you've got, you know, jazz, you've got reggae, you've got electronic, hip-hop, you know, it's all over the map.
Everything.
And I agree with you, it is all over the map. But I think it really works well as a collage-style piece. Every piece in this record is not an indulgent kind of, you know, here's a bunch of samples that I made. He's making songs out of them. And in that sense, he's in a class with people like DJ Shadow, like on the introducing record, or Jay Dilla, his hero, on Donuts. These are great songs in addition to being great examples of the art of sampling and what you can do out of it. So I think this is a great record.
There's a consistency with Shadow. I mean, yeah, like I said, as a musical collage, brilliant. But as a consistent, satisfying listening experience, I like half of it.
I think you got to look at it more as a greatest hits art record. A greatest hits without the, you know, it's not a collection of past stuff. It's like new stuff. It's kind of like, here's what I can do. And in that sense, I don't think any of these songs overstay their welcome. If you haven't listened to Madlib before, or you know just a little bit about him, not only his best album in a lot of ways, but also a great introduction to what he's all about.
Do you have thoughts on Goat Girl or Madlib? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, and let us know what you think. Coming up, we'll talk with legendary horror director and composer John Carpenter. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis, and that's a little bit of the theme from the classic horror film Halloween, directed and co-written by our guest today, John Carpenter. In addition to being a great director of movies like Halloween, Escape from New York, and They Live, my favorite, Carpenter composed the music to his films, and that music became iconic in its own right, even when removed from its original context.
Carpenter recently released a new album, Lost Themes 3, and he's joining us today to talk about that, as well as his career as a composer and a filmmaker. What an honor. John, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
From the beginning of your career as a director, certainly an incredible list of films, many of them that formed my life, from Halloween and They Live, Assault on Precinct 13, et cetera, et cetera. You always did the music. And I think I wasn't aware of that until the last couple of years when you began giving interviews more about the music and touring. My goodness. From early on, what was the impetus to do your own soundtracks?
Well, originally, and I'll be really honest with you, originally it came out of necessity. Because when you're making a low-budget film, when you have no money, you can't hire a composer or an orchestra. So if you have to do it yourself, a synthesizer is the best way to go, because you can sound big. You can sound full with the synthesizer. And so that's the route I took.
Well, you grew up in a musical family, and I hear it was violin originally thrust upon you. How do you go from violin, not being very happy with that, to playing in synth bands and in 60s bands, and then the film thing happens, and then the film and the music come together? What is that evolution like?
Oh, boy. It's not something I particularly planned out. I grew up musical household, so I grew up around music. The violin I played for several years, wasn't really any good at it, and wasn't happy doing it. But in the meantime, I picked up a little piano, and then I got interested in the guitar. And this was around the time of the British invasion, so the Beatles influenced me greatly. And I started playing guitar, and then I played in a band, and it just evolved from there musically. And it wasn't something I pursued vigorously at all. It just fell in my lap, like a lot of things. The movies was different. That was my first love. And that I fell in love with throughout my young years. And I saw a movie in 1956, and it so influenced me that I decided, you know, I have to become a movie director. I had figured out by that time that that's the guy who does all the creative stuff. So
the director. What was that 56 movie, John?
That was Forbidden Planet.
Yeah.
And actually, that was the first movie with an electronic soundtrack. All electronic music. I still listen to that soundtrack. I love that soundtrack.
You know, obviously being a movie fan, were you paying as much attention to the soundtracks as you were to the visual images?
Oh, sure. When you go to a Hitchcock movie, back in those days, it was always a spectacle, and it was always spectacular because of Bernard Herrmann's music. It was just great. Yeah.
The music was sort of like inherently part of the package that you were thinking about. You wanted to do it all. Were you concerned that, okay, I'm just not creative enough to do the soundtrack work or even have the time to do the movie that I've just made justice with the music? I'm curious how you integrated those two artistic impulses.
My integration of that was really simple. It's one job I completed before I started the other job. So directing a movie, or writing and directing and producing, whatever I did, I would do that completely. And mm-hmm. finish the movie up to the cut. I have a cut of the film with no music on it. And then I would sit down and start the music. And after spending my time getting the narrative right and getting the movie correct, then I would add music to it. And I, in the beginning, you know, I just didn't have any money nor time. So what I did for the first, in the very beginning, was to record like two or three themes that I could play in various places throughout the film. And then as my career evolved, I finally got to score to picture, which was just a whole different experience. And then the technology just keeps growing and keeps changing for the better and keeps maturing. Mm-hmm. And now the technology is unbelievable. So that's how it happens.
So that's fascinating, John. When you're on the set then with Jamie Lee Curtis or Kurt Russell, it wasn't like you had the tune in your head. You left all of that until later.
No, I would be singing a Beatles song or something, you know.
Because I've heard other directors like you know, Cameron Crowe, very different genre. You know, he would actually play music he didn't have the rights to yet to the actors on set to try to get them in the sort of mood he wanted. He, of course, wasn't a musician, a music critic. You know, you are a musician, but you didn't have the tunes in mind when you're making the movie. I make the movie, and then I put the music in the
That's
movie.
That's right.
Two separate jobs.
That's right. The ultimate director who used music on the set was Ennio Morricone. He would have the music composed before he shot the movie. And then he would play the music to the actors. Oh, man, that's just unbelievable.
John, you're noted for, you know, pioneering the use of synthesizers. Do you vary the kind of keyboards you use, or is there a go-to?
Well, I vary them, and I've landed on a couple. One is the Korg. I've been using that a lot recently. For the bass sounds, the Oberheim is just incredible. But even that's been supplanted by, you know, brand new programs. You can buy strings by Hans Zimmer. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You can get the BBC Orchestra to play for you. It's incredible stuff. I mean, the movie technology also is amazing nowadays, digitally. I mean, kids who want to make movies, you can do it. Just go do it. You've got the technology at your fingertips. No excuses.
Yeah. Create. Go out and create. So you work a lot with your son, Cody, and godson, Daniel Davies, frequent collaborators, generation younger than you. What's that like, getting to work with them, and what's the back and forth like?
It's a dream. I mean, look, one of the reasons I wanted to go touring with the music from his albums is I got to play with them live. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just an opportunity that I never imagined I'd have. And it's a dream come true. So they bring all sorts of gifts to the table. Daniel is by blood ties, is an amazing guitar player. You know, his dad was a lead guitar player, so he can play guitar like nobody. I mean, just incredible. And my son is a virtuoso keyboard player. He can play anything. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, these days, when we're doing scores, like we did the score for Halloween Kills, the new Halloween movie, I will sing something to Cody, and he can play it. So I don't even have to play anymore. I can remote control. See, this is what I'm looking at.
Yeah, that's very Brian Wilson of you there, John.
Yeah.
That's cool. You talk about these Lost Themes recordings. It's become a franchise. It's the third volume. You talked about them as a soundtrack for the movies in your mind. So do the titles come first, or you make the music up and then say, this sounds like The Dead Walk, or this sounds like Weeping Ghost? Or, I mean, how do you arrive at the themes?
Well, we make up the titles after the music is done. We started the Lost Themes 3 albums. We started making up titles with one, Skeleton was originally called Skeleton's Penis. And my son and godson suggested that that wouldn't be good for the album. I wanted it to be on the album. I thought we'd be avant-garde and daring, but no.
Yeah.
So it became Skeleton.
Are you really, though, John? Do you ever feel, and do Cody and Dan feel, that, you know, I mean, John Carpenter can put out Skeleton and Unclean Spirit, the two tracks that we've gotten so far from Lost Themes, but could you put out, you know, Happy Smiley Sunny Day?
Well, if you would pay me, I would be glad to. just put up a little money, and you got a smiley, happy day.
But you think people would want that from me?
Oh, I don't think so. But do you? I don't know. What the hell? I don't know. Maybe I should try that, huh?
Is there kind of an understanding that this would it'll be on the darker side of in keeping with the most John Carpenter movies? Is there an open-ended thing?
Well, that's kind of the stuff that I gravitate towards, and so I force my the kids to gravitate towards that too, to come up with, you know, thematic stuff that sounds like that. But listen, for the right money, we'll give you a little happy go lucky.
John Carpenter, for hire.
Yeah, that's it. Oh hell yes. You kidding?
Yeah.
Well, and John, when you're making the soundtrack for something like Halloween, was this totally kind of, you know, your own imagination working, or were you listening to different kinds of music, electronic music, for inspiration?
Well, I did listen to some electronic music for inspiration. I listened to music in general for inspiration. Bernard Herrmann, Dmitri Tiomkin, I listened to. I listened to a lot of classical music. I listened to rock and roll, Rolling Stones, the Beatles. So there's a lot of influences in there. But I didn't just sit down and listen to a bunch of electronic music and say, okay, now I've got it. See, you got to realize the early scores, these were scores that I could play. So they're bone simple. I mean, they are so simple. Because I can't play very well. Halloween is the most complicated thing I had to play. And I had to work on that over a period of years, just working on that exercise of playing.
When I listen to Halloween, when I go back to that original film, you know, you can hear a guy without the orchestra, without the talents of the orchestral musicians and his compositional talents, his conducting talents. You can hear your take on Herrmann, on Bernard Herrmann, on a synthesizer played simply. And it was a synthesizer not by choice. I guess that's what Greg was getting at. It was like, this was the convenient, relatively inexpensive instrument that I can use and make noise with.
That's correct. A piano and a synthesizer, that's absolutely correct. You guys have me nailed. You have me nailed. My ability is very limited. I don't have the talent, but I have the, the bullheadedness just to move forward.
So, and is the stuff that you're writing, I wonder how that's evolved, because, you know, are you actually putting notes on paper, or is it just strictly kind of in the kind of head arrangements, as they say, you know, guys, you know, you in a room inventing stuff on this instrument? And how is it working now with the trio format? Is it similar in approach, kind of more improvisational in the moment, or is stuff actually written down? Is it composed?
Nothing written down. It's all improv.
Mm-hmm.
All of it.
What's your favorite piece of music that you've worked on? The stuff that you've composed. Well, if you had to point somebody, hey, you know, let's not talk about the movies. Let's talk about the soundtracks or the albums that you've made. What piece stands out for you?
I have no idea. it was really fun to do it all, but it's not fun. It's hard work. See, yeah. This is why I kind of stopped it all, because, jeez, I can't do this anymore. I was making a movie and then doing the soundtrack to it. It's outrageous. I don't have a particular favorite, because the music for movies is inspired by the images, and each movie has unique images to it. So the music to Halloween Kills is very different than the first Halloween I did. They all go along with what's up on the screen in terms of soundtracks.
And Halloween Kills is finally coming out, I think, in 2021, too, right?
That's what the plan is, but you know what? We just don't know. I don't know what's going to happen.
Nobody knows, yeah. Right? I mean, how do you feel about that, John, both from the director's end, people now going to watch on their screens at home or on their phone, God forbid, and also as the live touring musician and, you know, your big touring circuit in 2017. I mean, both of them are gone to us. The experience of a big screen movie theater communal experience is gone. The experience of live concerts are gone. Do you think they'll come back?
Oh, boy. That's a big, giant question there you got. Well, it certainly has changed, and it's not what it was. I'm hoping that it returns to what we had, but I can't guarantee that. I don't know. I don't know. Driven by something that we have no control over, and neither do the studios, so...
Does it matter to you if people only see a film at home versus... Are you one of these people? You know, so Greg and I listen to so much music as music critics, right? We don't have the luxury of talking about the $10,000 Bang & Olufsen stereo. First of all, music critics don't make that kind of money. Second of all, we're listening so much all the time. You know, the high fidelity experience isn't one of our... So I'm kind of torn. I mean, there's movies that I saw in a theater that couldn't... That aren't the same seeing at home, but not always for the reasons you think. I remember I saw Halloween at the Stanley Theater in Jersey City, right? Uh-huh. So the Stanley Theater was a vaudeville palace that had fallen on hard days, you know, and it kind of was in a rough neighborhood. And, you know, people were smoking and drinking, and bums would come in and sleep. And, you know, I always remember that the African-American kids would cheer whenever the white kids got killed in a movie like Halloween or Friday the 13th. And I'd be sitting there a little scared, and every once in a while a rat would run across your feet. And this was perfect. I didn't want to see a John Carpenter movie anywhere else.
And you see, this is what my entire career has been geared to, that experience. And that is exactly... exactly the kind of movie experience I want everyone to have. It was what you had at the Stanley Theater.
So are we missing something by Netflixing it at home?
Of course, you know, unless you have the rats. Well, first of all, you know, in a perfect world, we have a communal experience with an audience,
yeah.
Which is, you can't match that. That's just incredible to have. But again, it's not my choice. It's not what I want.
Right.
And I don't know what to do about it.
We've been talking to John Carpenter, the great director and composer on Sound Opinions. John, thank you so much for being our guest.
I had a great time. Thank you very much for having me.
That wraps up our conversation with director and composer John Carpenter. As always, if you want to share your thoughts, record a message for us on soundopinions.org. When we come back, Greg and I will share some of our favorite film scores. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. And our conversation with director and composer John Carpenter got us thinking about some of our favorite film scores. Now, film scores are different from soundtracks, and we're defining them as pieces of music created specifically for a movie. Jim, why don't you go first?
Well, Greg, I'm shocked. I've made one passing reference, apparently, to this musician, but he was formative on young Jim, circa age 4, 5, 6, when I would sit, as long as they would run on Saturdays, and watch the Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies Warner Brother cartoons. There was a big Carl Stalling revival in the 90s. Stalling is another one of those fascinating musical careers, a story that doesn't get told often enough. He spent 2 years at Disney early on, but it was a little stifling. He moved on, and then for 22 years, 1936 until his retirement, he scored every single Warner Brothers cartoon short. Bugs Bunny, Roadrunner, you name it. More than 600 cartoons, right? Now think back, if you haven't seen a vintage Warner Brothers cartoon in a while, think back to the craziness that in these 3 or so minutes, so much happened so quickly, and for every single burst of action, the Roadrunner driving the coyote off the cliff, Elmer Fudd's gun exploding on him, right? All these things breeze by, and all of these things have 10 or 15 seconds of different music written for them, and it'll go from ragtime jazz to Bugs Bunny singing, opera, to crazy electronic music or avant-garde bebop that, could have, by musicians that could have been sharing the stage with Coltrane or later Ornette Coleman. Now, often Stalling was taking classical pieces or writing short pieces, and then this other weirdo that he fell in love with, Raymond Scott. Raymond Scott is one of the very earliest pioneers of the synthesizer, and he recorded tons of music that Warner Brothers licensed, and then Stalling would put this together. So in a way, Stalling really was a sample artist. I think if forced to choose one memorable Stalling-Scott collaboration, it would be Powerhouse.
Yeah, that's great.
Sometimes called Chaos in the Powerhouse. Basically, whenever you've got a Warner's cartoon where there's a malfunctioning production line, and a million things flowing off it, or any piece of machinery or a chase, you're going to hear this, and you will recognize it instantly. I am certain anyone who grew up spending any time in front of a TV. Carl Stalling, drawing on Raymond Scott, with Powerhouse on Sound Opinions. Powerhouse. Da, 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 da. I love that, Greg. Greg is smiling. You love it too, don't you?
Oh, yeah. In terms of soundtracks, my favorite era might have been the 70s with the blaxploitation movies. This genre of music of urban movies that, in fact, spawned an entire cottage industry of great movie soundtracks. And, in fact, I would say that a lot of the soundtracks were so good that they eclipsed the movies in terms of artistic value.
Curtis Mayfield, for sure.
Yeah. What I consider my favorite from that era, Across 110th Street. Mm. Some people may know the movie strictly because of the song title, Across 110th Street, but the soundtrack itself is incredible. It's written by bebop pioneer J.J. Johnson, the great trombonist, who evolved into a really funky dude in the 70s writing these soundtracks. And, he was in his 50s at the time, collaborating with Bobby Womack for the entire soundtrack. So Womack added some vocals to some of the tracks, including the leadoff track and the title song from the movie Across 110th Street. A lot of people may remember this being used very auspiciously in Quentin Tarantino's 1997 movie, Jackie Brown. It kicks off the movie and also ends it. And then Ridley Scott brought it back yet again for American Gangster in 2007. But the best use of it of all is in Across 110th Street. And the entire soundtrack is terrific, kind of creating the mood for this. You know, these films are essentially about African-American struggle in the inner city. And while the movies themselves were about violence and there was mayhem on the screen.
Yeah, I drug think
the,
dealing.
I think the soundtracks, including Womack, when they did have lyrics, were getting to the idea of the humanity behind it, the poignance, the fact that these people were in stressful situations all the time and got into the nuances of what it felt like to be a human being. Here's the title track from a great 1972 film and soundtrack, Across 110th Street by Bobby Womack and J.J. Johnson on Sound Opinions.
I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you put under pressure. Across 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across 110th Street, pimps trying to catch a woman that's weak. Across 110th Street, pushers won't let the junkie go free. Across 110th Street, woman trying to catch a trick on the street. You betcha. Across 110th Street, you can find it all in the street.
That is Across 110th Street, the title song from the 1972 film, one of my favorite soundtracks of all time.
Greg, I'm with you. What a great song. I'm going to go to Goblin next for my next score pick. We can't talk to John Carpenter in a show and then talk about scores without talking about the great Italian progressive rock band Goblin, who began scoring films for the Italian director Dario Argento, a huge influence on Carpenter, in 1975, Profondo Rosso in 75, and then Suspiria in 77. These guys existed as a band. They were progressive rockers, which meant they played in odd time signatures and had an analog synthesizer, you know, and were virtuosic. I played Suspiria a million years ago on the show as one of my all-time favorite Halloween tracks, so I want to go to something different that they did. Early on, when George A. Romero was revered by worldwide horror movie fans for Night of the Living Dead, and he made a sequel to it, Dawn of the Dead, 1978. That movie was not catching on. I remember seeing it at just before I turned 14. Holy cow, did that warp my brain, and being struck by the music. Now, some of the music is by Goblin, especially the longer cut. Argento did a cut of Dawn of the Dead for European distribution, and the music is there's more Goblin in it, and it's actually credited to Goblin and Dario Argento. But the creepy use of the Moog synthesizer and the odd rhythms and nobody does hide melodrama better, Greg, than the Italians, right? I mean, how many centuries of opera have you got
is
essentially that? Anyway, I'm going to play a track that Goblin called Zombie, Z-O-M-B-I, the Italian title of Dawn of the Dead, from Romero's great, I still don't, Night of the Living Dead, great, great movie, and has the racism subtext. But then Dawn of the Dead, you know, being anti-capitalism. The zombies return to the place they loved in life most to eat everybody, and that would be the shopping mall. There is the ultimate capitalist critique, if you ask me. Goblin on Sound Opinions. Goblin Zombie from the soundtrack to Dawn of the Dead.
Yes, indeed. You can't think of Dawn of the Dead without the music.
It just
makes the film in so many different ways.
And all the Argento films, the same thing. Yeah.
Well, and I would say the same about all those Sergio Leone westerns from the '60s. With the Ennio Morricone soundtracks. That I cannot separate those two things. The movies were great. The soundtracks were incredible. In fact, Leone left a lot of space in his movies for the music to carry the scenes and the plot and the character development in these movies. My favorite one, I think, might be Once Upon a Time in the West from 1968, where I think the combination of these sumptuous and at the same time dissonant classical orchestrations, because Ennio Morricone was very much a modernist classical composer.
Yeah.
Combined with elements of, you know, rock and the contemporary pop culture at the time, you know, the trebly guitars, etc. And in the case of this
Surf.
One song I'm going to play, referencing the blues very directly. Leone was so taken with Morricone's creativity that he had him compose the soundtrack actually before the movie was made. Here's what I want. Here's what the movie's going to be about.
Yeah.
Make a soundtrack for me. He had the actors and actresses performing to the soundtrack. So the soundtrack would be blaring over the speakers while the actors were going through their paces. And they said there would be tears on the set. People would cry during the while they were hearing the music for the first time. And there's lots of space in the movie, as I mentioned, these long silences. I mean, these characters don't say a whole lot in a movie.
Sometimes.
The expression is coming from the music. And it's particularly true of Charles Bronson in Once Upon a Time in the West. He's the guy playing the harmonica all the time, right? The harmonica is his voice.
Yeah.
It's got this kind of bluesy tone. He's cupping the harmonica like that's a trope of Western movies, like the cowboys sitting around the campfire playing the harmonica in a country-ish kind of way. He's kind of cupping it like a blues harpist would, but he's playing a blues kind of melody, but slowing it way down. So it sounds like there's death coming around the corner. Something's going to get you any second. I mean, it scares the bejesus out of you when you hear it. It's so eerie. And here's an example of what I'm talking about with Ennio Morricone's musical score, basically evoking an entire scene and carrying a theme throughout an entire movie with one track, Man with a Harmonica, from Once Upon a Time in the West on Sound Opinions.
Man with a Harmonica by Ennio Morricone. Greg, I guess a subplot of this show is that the Italians sure do movie scores well. Morricone or Goblin. As always, we want to hear what you think, though. What is your favorite movie score? Record a message for us with your thoughts and why on soundopinions.org. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we're due for another Buried Treasures episode. We're going to play some tracks that are flying underneath the mainstream radar, but that we think our listeners need to hear.
For more Sound Opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor@soundopinions.org. That's sponsor@soundopinions.org.
Sound Opinions is produced, as always, by Andrew Gill and Alex Claiborne, and we want to welcome our first Columbia College Chicago intern, Sol Delgadillo.